This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Hot Topics episode number 7 was recorded on March 12, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. There won't be any guest for this episode. It's just me, and the subject is an update on the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis. I'm going to lay out what is going to be my most bearish and, frankly, my most candid and honest assessment yet. So before going on, if you're one of the many people who seems to object to speculation on incomplete and inconclusive information about important public health matters like this, I certainly understand that perspective. But look, I'm not a public health official. My job is to speculate with incomplete and inconclusive information for the purpose of trying to gauge where financial markets are headed. This report is going to be considerably more concerning than my previous reports on this subject. If that's not for you, please just stop listening. Don't send me emails telling me it's irresponsible and that I'm fear-mongering. I'm not. I'm quite certain that I'm not afraid, I'm not panicking, I'm not spreading fear, I'm not spreading panic. If your reaction to the facts is to be alarmed or to panic or experience fear, those are your emotions, not my responsibility. So please, if this is not for you, don't listen. Sorry to have to start there, folks, but I've really been just beaten up on Twitter and in emails by a lot of people who think it's irresponsible of me to describe the facts as I see them. And these facts are extremely concerning. I think that what we're headed toward is a situation much worse than almost everyone expects. And I'm going to tell you why in this podcast. Now, this is an update. If you're a new listener, you really should start with hot topic number 6, which you can find at macrovoices.com. That is a rerun of my January 30th interview with Dr. Chris Martinson, talking all about the novel coronavirus, wasn't called COVID-19 at that point, and what was coming and what you needed to know about it. That interview really lays out the whole story. And then I have about a 25-minute update. This was just recorded a week or two ago, telling you what's happened since that interview and giving you the update. So hot topic number 6 at macrovoices.com is the best place to start. After that, listen to hot topic number 5, which is a panel including several of the most prolific people on financial Twitter who have been writing and reporting on this COVID-19 crisis ever since the news first broke in the middle of January. So I'm going to start with my forecast and outlook for what's coming, which is going to concern a lot of you. And then I'll spend the rest of today's podcast justifying and explaining why I think those things. Within 1 month, I expect the entire United States and all of Europe to be in a crisis bigger than almost everyone now expects. The best reference point for this is to look at the current situation and conditions in Italy. That's the template for what I think is coming to all of the United States in Europe within 1 month. A lot of people are not getting complete news on how bad things are in Italy. So on the homepage at macrovoices.com, in the description of this podcast, today's podcast, you'll find a link to a video by Dr. Chris Martinson. He does free daily COVID-19 videos. It's become a huge part of my life. My daily routine is to watch them as soon as they come out. I recommend that you do the same. Look at the latest one just from yesterday. And he talks about what really is going on in the Italian medical system and how they have been forced to turn away people who need critical care and just how bad things have gotten in that medical system. I believe that that's what's coming to the United States and the rest of Europe, first rest of Europe and then United States. Now, this is not a story about the sky's falling and everybody's going to die. It's not about death. The mortality rate, the case fatality rate for this virus is much lower than SARS or MERS, so we're not going to have, well, there will be plenty of deaths, probably hundreds of thousands of deaths before the whole crisis is over. But it's not going to be a story that's about the death rate. This is a story that's about the entire medical system being completely overwhelmed by the very large number of people who require hospitalization. Those are people who are going to have treatable and curable pneumonia. They get pneumonia from the virus. They need hospitalization. In many cases, they need to be put on mechanical ventilators in order to cure that pneumonia. And it won't be possible to help all of them because the medical systems will be overwhelmed with too many patients. So by early May, my prediction is that every hospital in the United States will be overloaded and unable to cope, unable to give care to all of the people that need it. People in dire need of medical care will be turned away, just as happened in China and is now beginning to happen in Italy. The situation will demand extreme action, but there will be very few options that will actually be effective to actually make anything better. The only useful measure is to stop human interaction. That means no events, no meetings. Forget about, you know, whether it's over or under 1,000 people. Don't see friends and invite them into your house unless you have to. It's going to be that kind of social isolation of just everybody stay home as much as you possibly can and avoid seeing other people because this virus is incredibly contagious and it spreads through asymptomatic spreaders. People who have no symptoms can still be contagious and give the virus to other people. I think this is going to lead to a profound sudden stop effect on the global economy, something that is bigger than anything we've ever experienced in modern history. I think there's plenty of scope for this economic event to be much larger than the 2008 global financial crisis. It's completely different in its nature. It's about needing to physically sudden stop the economy, shut things down. You don't have all of the financial drivers that existed in 2008 with mispriced derivative assets and so forth. This is about a sudden stop of productivity, a breakdown of supply chains and so forth. We've never experienced anything like it, so it's almost anyone's guess as to how it could turn out, but it's a bigger deal than markets are currently discounting. Everybody, I'm amazed at the people still today talking about what a great opportunity this is as we touched 2,600 overnight. As I'm recording this, we haven't yet gotten to the 9:30 open, and futures were trading limit down overnight. So we may go considerably below 2,600. A lot of people on Twitter talking about the incredible once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to buy this dip. I don't think this is the buy-the-dip moment, folks. I think that we've only seen the tip of the iceberg and that this crisis event is just barely getting underway. There will be second-order effects that will have dire consequences. If systems and supply chains break down to the point where the food distribution network in the United States stops working, because without commercial credit and so forth, you know, the just-in-time inventory systems, the reason that a store is called a store is back in the old days, they used to actually store many months' worth of supplies in the back room, and they'd only bring it out and put it on the shelves when it was needed. There is no back room anymore. Those shelves in your grocery store get supplied directly by the truck driver that brings supplies, and if those supply chains break down, you don't have a backlog of stored food in the stores. So we could get to major shortages of food and medical supplies and so forth as a result of the economic breakdown that I think is coming. Meanwhile, these extreme events, if they occur, could lead to just fanning the flames of division that already exists in society. And unfortunately, I think at least initially, the politicians on both sides of the aisle are going to use these events. You know, the Democrats will see this as a reason to blame President Trump for everything. I'm sure President Trump will make up a reason to make it the Democrats' fault. The desire in an election year of all of the politicians to make the other party look bad is just going to fan the flames of civil unrest and disobedience of quarantines and so forth. frankly, at this point, you know, I have made some money already trading this situation because it was very easy for me to see it coming from the end of January. Frankly, making more money on this is the last thing on my mind. I'm much more concerned at this point about my personal preparation to weather this storm and making sure the people that I care about are safe and are ready for what's coming. I encourage you to do the same. There's no reason for fear or panic. Fear and panic are not useful emotions. They don't help anything. But this is a time to be greatly concerned. The world is going through an event which was very, very easy to predict and see coming, but which governments have not reacted to. They haven't really done the preparation that they should have done to get ready for what's about to happen. Dr. Chris Martinson's videos, again, on Hot Topic number 6, we've got a replay of my January 30th interview with Dr. Chris Martinson. That's the most important thing to listen to if you haven't heard it yet, is Hot Topic number 6. After that, I recommend that you go to Martinson's website, peakprosperity.com, or just go to YouTube. And for now, they keep unsubscribing people because they're calling him a fake news guy because he's telling the truth. And he accurately predicted this crisis all the way back on January 20th. I would recommend that people watch all of his daily videos going back to January so that you can really come up to speed on the evolution of this crisis. Dr. Martinson has been on top of it from day one. His focus is not economic. His website is, he's one of these prepper guys, but he's the most level-headed of the prepper guys out there. And his website is all about people, or helping people to be prepared for major events that could disrupt society like this. So information about face masks and whether they work and whether they help and all that stuff, that's what his website is all about, and I recommend that you check that out. Now, I know that what I've just described sounds like lunatic fringe kind of stuff. I will make a couple of arguments. Number one, I've been dead nuts right about this ever since I started pushing it in the 28th of January was my first podcast on the subject. I then dropped everything and asked Julian Brigden, one of our favorite guests on Macro Voices, to share the spotlight with Dr. Chris Martinson so we could do a double feature interview that week because I knew it was so important to get Martinson in front of you because I knew what was coming. So I really have been pretty darn prescient in seeing what's coming, and unfortunately, I think the things that I've just described to you are pretty darn certain to happen. But I'll spend the rest of this podcast substantiating and justifying the reasons that I believe the things that I have just described. As I've been speaking, we hit 9:30 in the morning on Thursday, and with the opening of the cash stock market, that unlocks the previously limit-down locked overnight futures market, and we immediately gapped down about another 40 points to 25.63, 62, 61, 60. I'm just literally watching the S&P erode at just a few minutes after 9:30 as I'm recording this. So let me now continue and tell you why I feel so sure about the things that I've just described. Let's start by understanding what happened in China, why it went so horribly wrong, and what mistakes were made there, which led to more Chinese than the entire population of the United States. At the peak of the lockdowns, they had about 400 million Chinese citizens on lockdown, not allowed to leave their homes, not allowed to travel. That's more than the population of the United States. Now, the first cases in Wuhan occurred in October and November. Dr. Li Wenliang, the late Dr. Li Wenliang, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing his name, was the medical doctor who first realized that a pandemic was occurring. He raised the alarm bells around the 2nd of January to say, okay, folks, as a medical doctor, my assessment is we have an epidemic level event on our hands. We need to make serious preparations, communicated with his colleagues and so forth. He was promptly arrested, detained, and severely punished for the crime of spreading rumors. That's how the Chinese government dealt with this. They were not inclined to take this medical doctor seriously. They focused much more on suppression of public awareness than proactively getting ready to deal with this developing crisis. As a result, within weeks, 400 million Chinese were on total lockdown. Desperate people in dire need of medical care were being turned away from hospitals. Body bags were literally littering hospital hallways. There were rumors that seemed very likely to be true that they not only built emergency hospitals, but built emergency crematoriums, and there were mass cremations and a much higher death toll than was publicly reported. The really important question that nobody is willing to ask is if during all of this, we continued to fly infected people in and out of China every single day on airline flights all over the world through mid-January as things were really peaking in terms of the situation in Wuhan, why in the world wouldn't you just automatically expect that the inevitable outcome of that was that, you know, if it took about 3 months from first cases in October till the whole thing really blew up suddenly in January, well, why wouldn't you expect that the rest of the world had just been infected with this very, very contagious disease, and about 3 months later, the same thing would happen to the rest of the world? There's no logical reason for anyone not to come to the conclusion that that's what was likely to happen. When I started raising questions like that on Twitter, people got very angry with me, and they would say things like, you know, you idiot, Eric, there haven't been any deaths outside of China. What the hell are you talking about? Well, of course there hadn't been. Well, there's no reason to expect any. There's a long incubation period for this virus. It took 3 months from first cases until the really extreme outbreak occurred in Wuhan. It stands to reason that as the virus was spread all over the world, there would be early cases, a lot of them would be asymptomatic, and it wouldn't really turn into a crisis like we're seeing in Italy until about 3 months later. It was so easy to see this coming, and I said it in January. Dr. Chris Martinson was just screaming at the top of his lungs in his videos saying, why don't governments shut down travel right now? He said that, I think, on January 20th. And at the time, the World Health Organization was expressly telling governments not to do that. They were saying there's no reason to restrict trade. There's no reason to restrict travel. That's crazy. It's so logically obvious. Anyone who's capable of logical deduction should be able to see that the most likely outcome was going to be that we had exported this virus from China all over the world, and about 3 months later, there would be Wuhan-like situations all over the world. So let's discuss now some success stories of places where this started to break out, but didn't go out of control, did not go out of control the way Wuhan did, because obviously we want to learn from those. Singapore. Holy cow, I remember talking to Jim Bianco about this when Singapore cases first started to be detected. The rate of exponential growth in cases looked just as bad as Wuhan. Now, it was only a handful of cases, but the rate at which they were increasing every day, the percentage of 30% or more per day of increase in the case count, caused Jim Bianco and myself. Jim Bianco is Bianco Research, super guy, must follow on Twitter, at Bianco Research. Great charts showing all of the data that I'm talking about. I recommend that you peruse his Twitter feed and look at all of his great graphs and charts that support a lot of the things that I'm saying in this podcast. Jim and I became very concerned. Okay, Singapore is the next Wuhan. This really looks bad. But the Singapore government was extremely proactive in aggressively testing. They got their ability to do testing for this virus up and running very quickly. They did very aggressive contact tracing, meaning that anybody who gets it, they want to know everybody you've talked to, everything you've done for the last 3 weeks, and they go and find every person that you've come into contact with, and they test them too. They're very, very good about imposing quarantines and being extremely conservative in isolating infected people and not taking any chances. Now, despite all those measures, at first that exponential growth continued, and Jim and I were both thinking, boy, this thing is going Wuhan any day now. But to this date, Singapore has less than, I think it's 180 cases today. They managed to cap it off and get it under control, and they have very low case growth now. So it is possible through proactive, diligent, aggressive action to contain this virus and get it under control. Now, they still suffered significant collateral damage with a couple of hundred cases and several deaths. It's not like it was no big deal, but it's nothing like what Italy is experiencing. I'll come back to Italy in just a few minutes. Hong Kong. Remember, Hong Kong was the epicenter of the SARS outbreak in 2003. And having lived in Hong Kong full-time for several years, I can tell you everyone in Hong Kong remembers SARS, and the entire society is very much ready to take any kind of public health and hygiene issue seriously. So people in Hong Kong don't joke about such things. They take it very, very seriously. And I think that culture was ready to respond to this. They implemented aggressive testing, aggressive contact tracing, isolation of infected cases, all the same things that Singapore did, closed down travel to mainland China. To date, they only have 126 cases, so the controls are working again in Hong Kong. Let's talk about South Korea next, and it's a really, really important one to understand and examine, because something went very differently in South Korea than it went in Singapore and Hong Kong, and it occurred despite the fact that, in my opinion, South Korea really wins the prize in terms of the best response that any government has shown to this crisis. They've done an absolutely fantastic job. What happened in South Korea was the breakout began in the city of Daegu. There was one really big super spreader event, and perhaps the nature of that one event and the number of people that it seeded so quickly is what's different, because the situation in South Korea just mushroomed to a much, much, much larger case count, more than 10 times as many cases as Hong Kong and Singapore, but probably more than 10 times those numbers combined. What happened? Why was it different? It started with this one super spreader event. Ironically, the woman who is identified as the case that brought this about had been asked to take a coronavirus test because she was feeling ill, and she refused, citing the fact that she had not traveled internationally as justification for why she shouldn't have to. She then went to, it's not just a regular church gathering, but it was almost like a cult-oriented thing, from what I understand, a very large gathering of people at a religious event that involves a whole lot of people in very close quarters. A whole lot of people were infected from that event. Now, that was how things got started with the spread of the virus, but the government did almost everything right. They made one key mistake, which I'll touch on, but what they did is they were just incredibly innovative in aggressive testing. They realized very early on, wait a minute, if we set up a testing center with a waiting room, people are going to go there to get tested, and whether they were infected or not, by the time they're done sitting in the waiting room, they're going to be infected. This is no good. They realized that what they needed was drive-through testing, where you literally drive up to something that looks sort of like a drive-through teller at a bank, and the medical staff are there. You stay in your vehicle, and they administer the swab test and test you for coronavirus. And the delivery of test results is automated to your cell phone using an SMS text message. Furthermore, there's an app for your cell phone that does proximity detection. So the system knows who the infected people are. They know where their cell phones are. And if you're walking into an area where there's infected people around you, your cell phone beeps and tells you, hey, you know, you're in an area where there are several people who have tested positive for the coronavirus. Be careful. Make sure you wear your face mask. So they've done just incredibly insightful and innovative things to get ahead of this. Aggressive contact tracing. The one mistake that they made, they never did lock down travel to and from Daegu. They still had public transit and a train that was going back and forth to Seoul every day. So they probably had a lot of transmission to Seoul from Daegu through public transit that they could have avoided if they had been a little bit more aggressive about locking down transportation between cities, and particularly if they had done that much earlier on in the crisis. But aside from that one mistake, they really are clear world leaders, as far as I'm concerned, in being incredibly innovative, and it seems to have finally worked. They're just now, in the last few days, their very, very rapid case count growth, which took them up to 7,750, so that's more than 10 times Hong Kong and Singapore combined, It's just now starting to come under control. Yesterday, they had 242 cases, nothing to shake a stick at. But compare that to Italy, which had 2,313 new cases yesterday alone. So despite world-class containment, testing, and technology innovation, it's taken them almost 8,000 cases, and they're just starting to get this thing under control, and it's not under control quite yet. So why the heck has there been such a big difference between the experience of Singapore and Hong Kong versus the experience of South Korea? One possibility, we know for sure that there are two strains of this virus. The L strain is the more serious one, the one that was in Wuhan. The S strain is the original version of this before it mutated, which is not quite as deadly and not quite as contagious. Could it be that maybe somehow Hong Kong and Singapore had the S strain, which is not quite as deadly, and that's why they were more easily able to contain it? Seems kind of hard to believe, since Hong Kong has so much travel to and from Wuhan, where they had the L strain. It's hard for that to make sense. I think that locking down travel, and probably more importantly, the fact that the Hong Kong culture was so ready to adapt and instantly take this very, very seriously. Everybody in Hong Kong has memories of the 2003 SARS event, and they take it very, very seriously. I don't know exactly what went differently, but that's something that we really need to study more of, is why did South Korea have such a greater challenge than Hong Kong and Singapore had? Why did Hong Kong and Singapore get off easy relative to South Korea? I don't know that answer. I guess the only thing I see objectively is that South Korea was a little bit slow to lock down travel between cities. Let's move on now to Italy, and I believe this is the most important one to understand because I think it's a proxy for what's coming to the rest of Europe and to the United States. What has gone so terribly wrong in Italy? And just to put it in context so you understand how terribly wrong it's gone, just 7 to 10 days ago, the story was, hey, you know, let's not blow things out of proportion. Yes, there's a handful of cases in Italy, but hey, it's nothing like South Korea. It's nothing anywhere near that order of magnitude. Well, a week later, it's nothing like South Korea, that's for sure. Italy has far more cases than South Korea, even though it had 1/10 as many cases as South Korea did. It now has about 30% more cases than South Korea. So Italy started from way behind and overtook South Korea and has far more cases, more deaths, and their entire healthcare system is failing. Be sure to watch that video from Dr. Chris Martinson to get some perspective on what's going on with their medical system. Just yesterday, 2,313 new cases discovered in Italy. And those are the new cases. Meanwhile, the total death count for Italy is up to 827 now. There were 196 deaths, almost 200 deaths yesterday alone. So on a day when South Korea seems to have gotten things reined in, they're at 7,755 cases, 242 new cases yesterday. Italy had almost 200 new deaths yesterday and 2,300 new cases. Situation in Italy is spiraling out of control. They're not doing all of the innovative things that South Korea did with drive-through testing that's free for everyone and automated delivery of test results to your cell phone and all those things that were done in South Korea. Look at the result. They went from a 10% as many cases as South Korea had to, so far as I just eyeball this, there are 12,462 cases in Italy as of yesterday, compared to 7,755 in South Korea total. So Italy is not yet twice as many cases as South Korea, but give it a couple of days and it will get there. So what went so horribly wrong? I don't know if this L versus S strain thing is a contributor, but clearly if it is a contributor, Italy has the L strain, which is the more deadly version. I think what really happened, though, was Italy was completely unprepared for this, despite months of knowledge. Dr. Chris Martinson on January 20th was saying governments around the world need to understand that this horrible, horrible thing going down in China, we're flying people in and out of Wuhan, China every single day all over the world. They're taking this virus to the rest of the world. It's coming. We need to get ready for it. nobody wanted to even take it seriously. They didn't prepare. They didn't develop apps to inform you over your results from drive-through testing over the cell phone. What happened very, very quickly was Italy was overwhelmed. First, just a couple of towns in the northern part of the country. They hesitated to even lock down those towns. They did that. Before they knew it, a week later, they're locking down the entire country. We've had listeners to Macro Voices reporting into us from Italy saying the situation there is absolutely dire. Again, Chris Martinson's video from yesterday paints a grim but very accurate picture of what's going on there. It's what's coming to the United States and to the rest of Europe. I'm convinced of that. Their medical system has now reached total saturation, exactly as Chris Martinson predicted when I interviewed him on Macro Voices on January 30th, six full weeks ago. They're much bigger in terms of cases than South Korea. And more important, there's no sign of it slowing down yet. South Korea is slowing down. They were at one point 1,500 cases a day. Now they're down to 242 cases a day. Despite the low fatality rate, there is a horrific humanitarian medical crisis going on in Italy. As Dr. Martinson explains in his video, they're literally taking people who are not really medical doctors and saying, oh, you've got a PhD in something in astrophysics? Well, you're a doctor. We need help at the hospital, you know, anybody. It's really crazy there. They've had to convert all of their intensive care units into standard care units because they need the floor space. That means somebody needs intensive care. Sorry, we can't do that. The entire hospital system is overwhelmed, and that crisis in Italy is nowhere near peaking in terms of the maximum amount of pain and number of cases. Now, here's the most important thing I'm going to tell you in this entire podcast today. Although it's true that Italy has a very large number of cases and deaths and new cases per day and so forth, and in comparison, in absolute terms, the number of cases in other European countries and the number of cases in the United States, it seems like it's a tiny number in comparison. The reason is exponential growth. A better way to understand this for people who don't intuitively understand exponential growth is forget about the absolute numbers. Look at it this way. What Europe and the United States are is about exactly 10 days behind Italy on the exponential growth curve. In other words, 10 days from now, the rest of Europe, and I think the United States might be more like 14 days behind, 2 weeks from now, the United States is going to be in the same condition that Italy is in right now in terms of the explosion of case growth and so forth. Now, in the United States, they've been extremely slow in instituting community testing. So, you know, if you don't test and don't tell, you're not going to have reporting of that explosion in case growth. But in terms of the infections that are actually occurring, it's going to go the way of Italy. So the guideline is the rest of Europe is about 10 days behind Italy on the exponential growth curve. United States is maybe 14 days behind Italy on the exponential growth curve. It's only a matter of time. And in the next couple of weeks, I think that the shit's going to hit the fan. And from a financial standpoint, the shit's going to hit the tape. So let's talk now about case growth and how to understand it. Case growth outside of China, cases, infections of COVID-19 outside of China. And the reason I go outside of China is much later in its cycle. It's already peaked there. It's not completely under control, but they're getting it under control. We need to look at the rest of the world, the people that didn't get infected until all of those flights in and out of China in January carried the infection all over the world. All those flights that the smartest people were begging governments to shut down and that the World Health Organization was telling them there's no reason to even consider restricting or limiting travel and commerce. The ex-China cases grew tenfold from 1,000 to 10,000 in the 13-day period ending on March 2nd. For the sake of round numbers, let's call it 14 days instead of 13 days. That's 2 weeks. It's much easier to follow it on the calendar that way. So that would project another, it's not another 10,000 cases in the next 2 weeks. It's another tenfold increase. So we go from 10,000 cases to 100,000 cases outside of China in the next 14 days through March 16th. Well, here we are on March 12th. The latest data that I have is for yesterday, March 11th. We had 46,000 cases outside of China. So at first glance, if you're not used to thinking about exponential growth, it sounds like, wait a minute, it's not growing as fast as I'm suggesting it should. Actually, it is. You would expect the most of the growth to happen in the last few days. That's just the way exponential functions work. So the case doubling time, not the 10 times, but the doubling time, is 4 to 5 days right now outside of China. From March 11th to March 16th is 5 days. So a doubling of 46,000 cases would get you to 92,000 cases by March 16th versus, I said a minute ago, the projection was 100,000. Pretty darn close. Could be off by a day. I don't know. I sure hope it is. The slower this goes, the better it is for humanity. But the point is, we're tracking about a tenfold increase in number of ex-China cases in the world every 2 weeks. So it's a times 10 in 2 weeks. Through March 16th, it'll get us to 100,000 cases approximately outside of China. Some of them won't be reported. They may not be reflected in official statistics. That's just because a lot of places like the United States are incredibly, incredibly derelict in their responsibility to do widespread community testing. As of last night, I believe the statistic was still less than 5,000 total COVID-19 tests have been administered in the United States. Little tiny, by relative terms, the smaller country of South Korea has done well over 100,000 tests. So we really need to get our act together. That projects to 1 million cases, another tenfold increase outside of China by March 30th, 10 million cases outside of China by April 13th, and 100 million cases outside of China by April 27th. Again, a tenfold increase every 2 weeks. Now, to be sure, there's no possible way that we're going to have 100 million reported cases in the official data. We don't have enough tests. If we can't do the tests, we can't diagnose the cases. So I am not predicting that the official number will be anywhere close to 100 million outside of China by April 27th. But I am predicting that number of infections, or actually a little bit less than that, because human behavior is going to change. As this really goes the way of Italy in the rest of the world, as the rest of Europe and the United States are overwhelmed with conditions similar to Italy, people will change their behavior. The reckless, nonchalant, oh, it's just the flu attitude is going to go away. People will be freaking out. They'll be self-isolating voluntarily, and that will change the transmission rate. So let's say if the projection under the old transmission rate was 100 million cases outside of China, I don't expect it in the official numbers, but if I was going to project that as infections occurring, even if they don't get reflected in numbers because of lack of testing and overwhelming of the medical facilities, let's say it doesn't really happen by April 27th. Let's give it till the middle of May, another 2 weeks, just because human behavior will have slowed the transmission as people start to be a little bit more responsible about doing things that governments and the World Health Organization should have told them to do a full month ago, which is to self-isolate as much as possible, avoid interaction with other people, and be just incredibly diligent about washing your hands and using hand sanitizer, not handshaking unless you have to, or not having to, refusing to, changing behavior and so forth. That's the best way to actually contain this. It's called NPI, non-pharmaceutical interventions, changing behavior so that we reduce the transmission of the virus. Everybody's still focusing on the case fatality rate. Everything you hear out of the U.S. government is, look, don't worry, the mortality rate is lower than you think. People are not going to die from this. Well, there's truth to that. The mortality or case fatality rate is much lower than SARS or MERS. This is not a story about everyone dying. This is a story all about the serious complication rate, the statistic that the government never seems to even acknowledge. We know it's at least 15%. It might be as high as 20%. It's the percentage of people who get infected with the virus who will need hospitalization in order to deal with the virus. 15% of 100 million, that's the low-end estimate, which is even the US CDC officially acknowledged this week, They expect one-third of all Americans to be infected with this virus before this is over. So that's more than 100 million Americans. 15% of those, the low end of the range, is 15 million people. There's less than 500,000 hospital beds in the United States. That means for every hospital bed, 30 people need it. And they're all contending for medical care. So the same exact thing that was described in Chris Martinson's video last night, the one which is linked in the description of this podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com, medical care is going to be affected in the same ways that's described in that video where you live, everywhere in Europe, all through the United States. Eventually, I don't know what the current case development pace is in Australia and other parts of the world, but this is going all around the world. The cat's out of the bag. It was possible to contain it early on. We didn't do that. Now, in the United States, the land of denial, as recently as Tuesday of this week, President Trump tweeted that, look, don't worry, it's going to go away by itself. Needless to say, from his address from the Oval Office last night, it seems like even the president is finally starting to wake up to what should have been obvious in around the 20th to the 28th of January, when smart people started figuring out what was coming. He's finally implemented a 30-day ban on travel to Europe. That should have been done in January. The CDC is coming clean and admitting that at least one-third of Americans are eventually going to get this virus. Dr. Mark Lipsitch, who is a very prominent epidemiologist with Harvard University, a professor, I believe, at Harvard University, had estimated 40 to 70% of all human beings on the planet, maybe a total of 5 billion with a B people, are going to contract this virus as a result of this pandemic. So, you know, the low end of the range is probably what the CDC number is, 100 million people in the United States. The high end of the range is double that, 200 million people in the United States. We don't have enough hospital beds to deal with just 10 million people in the United States getting this. So we've got a really serious problem coming, and it's probably in the month of May that the U.S. healthcare system will experience a systemic failure along the lines of what is just starting to occur right now in Italy. And I think it's going to get worse in Italy before it gets better. So I think that it's inevitable that we're going to see a massive shutdown of commerce, travel, and so forth. And if you look at what's happening in Italy, where they've had to impose a national lockdown, as unthinkable as that seems, that seems to be the only way to contain this virus. If we had to lock down the entire United States economy and all of Europe, that is an economic event which is completely unprecedented. I think there's plenty of room to say that this could be a much, much larger economic dislocation than the 2008 financial crisis. As far as where I think it will play out in financial markets, first and foremost, you know, my opinion, folks, is worry first about you and the people you love and whether you're prepared to weather what's coming. Worry about making money on this in financial markets after the fact. That's not really what's important. But if you want to know where I think this plays out, my shorts have been on crude oil. And the reason is simply that they're going to have to shut down travel and commerce and airlines and so forth. It creates a huge demand destruction. Now, this is even before this whole rift between Saudi Arabia and Russia broke out, which spiked the price down $10. I think even if Russia and Saudi Arabia kiss and make up, we're still going to low 20s on crude oil. And the reason is that you can't just flip a switch and turn off production. The way these things work, if you want to shut in oil wells, you don't just turn the switch off and tell the employees not to come to work for the next 2 weeks. It's a big and expensive process to close things down, and it's a big and expensive process to bring them back up again. So production, which is in production, is going to stay in production. It's going to result in too much oil, and all of a sudden, we're going to have an just incredible storage crisis. There won't be, you know, if you've got a swimming pool in your backyard, think about filling it up with crude oil, because there's not going to be any storage tanks anywhere in the world to hold all of the excess crude oil that's going to need to go in storage, because we can't shut down the production quickly, and we're going to have a sudden stop in demand as things play out around the world. So I think that's where crude oil is probably what gets hit hardest. Bond yields are already crashing. We got down to about 30 basis points on the 10-year yield the other day. It's double that now, bouncing, so huge volatility. Stocks, yes, it's amazing. We were locked limit down. We closed last night, and I think the number was on the S&P was 27.28. That was on the June contract, so it was probably 10 points higher on the March contract. 27.28 on the S&P. When I started recording this podcast, we were locked limit down before the market opened at about 2,600. And as I turn to my screen now, we hit 2,480 on the S&P was the bottom. We're now bouncing almost 100 points off of that low in a reaction bounce at 2,548 as I speak at about 10:15 on Thursday morning. So markets are crashing. I don't think that this economic event has barely even gotten started yet. Does that mean markets, you know, go dramatically down from here? In the case of the stock market, I don't know, because central banks seem so prone to want to rescue the stock market at any cost. You know, the guys with the printing press have the opportunity to rescue the stock market if that's what they want to do. So I think the more assured way of playing this in financial markets is going to be bond yields and particularly crude oil. It's going to be lots of medical winners and losers in this. Life insurance is already crashing. Obviously, people are anticipating there's going to be more life insurance claims and that life insurers are going to be crushed. You know, all I can think of in terms of the long-term implications of this is there's going to be so much federal bailout and stimulus and disaster recovery aid that's going to be needed to get society through what's coming. If I can channel Arnold Schwarzenegger in his Terminator role, they're going to need a bigger printing press. That's where we're headed. So gold has to win in the end. I think the big winner of this crisis financially is gold. But just like in 2008, what happened then is when the stock market was crashing, gold crashed with it because people were selling their gold to meet margin calls. So if that happens again, it is a godsend. It is an opportunity to buy gold on sale, even though the fundamentals are just getting better and better by the minute. And as I speak to you now, I just glanced at my chart because I thought it was going to be down a little. It's down a lot. Looking at gold at 1580. So that is more than $100 per ounce down from where it was just a few days ago. What's going on? Does this mean this is bad for gold? Ultimately, this is very good for gold. The reason gold is crashing right now is because the stock market is crashing right now. And I think that it could have a lot farther to go. If we had a chance to buy 1350 gold, boy, that would be great. I think we could get back down there. And from a technical analysis standpoint, that's the place. Depending on how bad this gets, it might go even lower than that. But, you know, the lower it goes, the better of a bargain it is, because I'm convinced that these events are actually going to eventually drive gold well over $2,000 an ounce. So gold is going to be the play, but I don't think the best entry opportunity for gold is quite yet. Stock market's going to pull it down. Election dynamics are another aspect of this. I try to be politically agnostic. For the record, I'm neither a Trump supporter or a Trump hater. I try to be agnostic. I think all of the candidates, frankly, are pretty disappointing. The thing that I see here is I just don't see how Trump can win the election with how badly this is about to go and how outspoken he was early on telling everybody it's just the flu. The Democrats are going to have a field day with a clip from that one press briefing where he says, okay, folks, you know, look, the seasonal flu has a much higher case fatality rate than this COVID-19 thing does. Well, even Dr. Fauci admitted publicly this week that COVID-19 is at least 10 times more deadly than the seasonal flu. I think that's wrong. If you use the WHO's World Health Organization's 3.4% case fatality rate for the COVID-19, and the seasonal flu is a 0.07% case fatality rate. Now, of course, every flu season is different, but that's an average over several years. You get something like 50 times more deadly than the seasonal flu. And the president, in an official briefing, told the country that the seasonal flu was more deadly. Democrats are going to have a field day with that. I also think that as much as right now, by almost any reasonable measure, it looks like Bernie Sanders is completely out of the running. There's no way that guy could ever win. He's behind Hillary Clinton in the polls, and Hillary's not even running officially. The thing is, Bernie has been the guy that people have really, really identified with his wanting to give free health care to everyone. When we get into a health care crisis, if Bernie is still running, his message is not going to be, come and vote for me because you agree with my socialist views about the way the world ought to work. It's going to be, vote for me because you and your family are going to die if we don't take over the healthcare system and socialize it, and your life depends on coming out to the polls and voting for me. That could be a very compelling story. Not right now. Bernie's being laughed out of the room right now. When we get to the point in May where the United States looks like Italy does right now, with its healthcare system failing as badly as Italy's is, I think suddenly there's, and frankly, you know, Bernie wouldn't have done any better in a government-managed healthcare system than the current system. But that's not the way that they're going to spin it to voters. So I think that Bernie still has a chance. Political gaming, unfortunately, both sides are going to try to use this crisis to make the other side look bad. And that's only going to fan the flames of unrest and divisiveness across the country. So I sincerely hope, folks, to be wrong about everything here. If I have gotten all of this wrong, you know, I will be the first one to celebrate and call myself an idiot. But frankly, I've been dead nuts on exactly what was going to happen. I laid this out in January 30th when I dropped everything to get Chris Martinson onto the podcast. I bought a whole bunch of S&P puts, so I certainly have made my share of mistakes in this. I bought a huge number of S&P puts on January 28th that expired and expired worthless on February 14th, because I thought it was so clear that by February 14th, surely the market would have crashed by then. And of course, it went the opposite direction. Fortunately, I took a significant loss on that position, but I saw that it was not going my way. I took it off and I redeployed that capital on puts on crude oil. And needless to say, those have paid off very well. So I'm ahead of the game in the end. I don't think, though, that this is really a time to worry that much about how to make money on this. I really encourage listeners to watch Dr. Chris Martinson's videos. By the way, Martinson has been the tragic hero in this story. His YouTube channel was demonetized, which means he doesn't even get to recover his production costs for producing these videos and giving them away for free every day because he was labeled as a fake news site. Why? Because he predicted back in January that a global pandemic was coming. Everybody called him a fearmonger and said that he was just trying to stoke fear for the sake of getting more views on YouTube. In reality, I'm sure that he saved a lot of lives, and I'm going to make a donation to Dr. Martinson and his efforts, and I encourage you to consider doing the same, especially if you've benefited, as I have, from his daily videos. Take care of the people that you love first. Worry about making money in the markets afterwards. As far as the crude oil market, which is a big part of this story, we're going to do a separate podcast by request. We've got Tracy Shuchart, Shy Girl, on Twitter. That's coming hopefully tomorrow. I've got a recording session scheduled for later this afternoon, Thursday, with Tracy. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.